This podcast is brought to you by the American Enterprise Institute.
If you like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, review, and share.
Thanks for listening. Here's our show.
What in the hell's going on?
What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I don't know what the hell he's talking about.
You don't have to know what the hell is on it.
What the hell's the matter with these guys?
We don't know what's going on.
What the hell's going on?
Who in God's name knows what it's all about?
Hi, I'm Danielle Pletka.
And I'm Mark Thiessen.
Welcome to our podcast, What the Hell is Going On? Mark, what the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on is Harvard University has had what many have been calling its Bud Light moment. when it has suffered a reputational damage that is lasting and possibly unrecoverable. And we have with us the former president of Harvard University to talk to us about this. Larry Summers is somebody who I have enormous respect for because he is a loyal Democrat. He's a man of the left, probably he'd say the center left, but he's willing to criticize his own side. And he calls balls and strikes like he sees them. And he does. He's not a team player in the worst sense of that word when the team is bad or doing the bad things. He's willing to call them out. I kind of model him a little bit, try to model him in my life. I'm a loyal conservative. I'm a man of the right. But I'm willing to call out people on my side when they do the wrong thing. I think you're the same way. And I think that's how we should all be, because that's the only way you can have decent conversations about problems in the world. And Larry Summers is willing to do that. And so he's going to talk to us about where he thinks we go a little too far in our criticism of Harvard, where he thinks the criticism is justified, and the broader problems of the academy. It's a really fascinating conversation.
Yep, it certainly is. I love the way you describe him because I think that's exactly right. What we are missing in this country is civil discourse about the problems that affect us all. You know, whether you have kids in school or you're in your office, you're worried about wokeness or you're worried about excesses on the right, there's a way to talk about these kinds of things. And you're exactly right.
It's not just civil discourse, it's also honest discourse and self-critical discourse, because, you know, we can civilly, you know, disagree, which is we need more of. But we also need each side of the political spectrum to police their own sides, their own movements, right? We have to,
right?
We have to criticize conservatives when conservatives say stupid things and do stupid things. And we need more people on the left who are willing to do that to their side. And Larry is willing to do that. And good for him and good for us and good for our listeners that they get to hear it.
So one of the things, Larry said a lot of great things that I think our listeners are really, really going to appreciate in our conversation. But one of the things that he said that really stayed with me, and so I'm going to steal his thunder by repeating it before the interview, is that the left, and in the case we were talking about Harvard, has embraced this broken windows theory of policing progressivism. Now, what's broken windows? Some folks will remember that this is a theory of policing that essentially argues that you go in at the very beginning when you face problems of lawlessness, i.e., a broken window, rather than waiting for the guy to break windows to then knock over a 7-Eleven, rob an Uber driver, murder somebody. You get people right at the beginning and you reduce crime. Maybe you set them on a different path, but no matter what, you set that neighborhood on a different path. It was a transformative, absolutely transformative means of policing when it was put into place in New York in the 1990s. And it's since been gotten rid of by all of their woke leaders and everybody else.
Well, the left doesn't even embrace it on policing, so they're not going to embrace it in the academy.
Well, no. But what he says is the left has now become a purveyor of this broken windows idea, in that they will not just get angry at you for an overt act of racism, right? They will not just get angry at you because of hostility towards their causes. They will now go after you at any sign that you might possibly. And so if you are wearing a sombrero, you are suddenly a cultural appropriator. And yes, you are a racist, right? It's how things have been turned on their head. And I'm sorry, folks, I'm talking endlessly, but usually Mark talks endlessly, so that's fine. But how things have been turned on their head for this absolute culture of intolerance.
Well, so the problem right now isn't that too many kids are being harassed for wearing sombreros on campus. It's that they're being harassed for wearing yarmulkes. That's the big problem we have on college campuses right now, which is that it is open season on Jews at Harvard University, at other places. And I'm not exaggerating in the sense that literally a few months ago, a woke mob of pro-Hamas protesters literally surrounded and started pushing around a Jewish student, and the person who was doing it was the editor of the Harvard Law Review. So we're not exaggerating when we talk about the rise of anti-Semitism. And all of a sudden, you know, these same Marxists who don't believe in free speech when it comes to normal conservative thought and normal conservative speech, mainstream conservative speech, have suddenly become free speech absolutists when it comes to protecting the rights of people to, you know, openly call for the destruction of the state of Israel. And this is all fine and good. And, you know, one of the questions that I ask Larry is that if I was a professor at Harvard who said that we should, you know, drive all black people out of America from sea to shining sea and send them back to Africa, how long would I be a faculty member at Harvard? And, you know, he's against firing people over positions, but put aside firing. I mean, there would be protesters outside that person's office. Yeah, you know, that if I wrote that as a column in the Washington Post, they wouldn't publish it and I'd be fired. You know, and this is, but you can say the same thing about Jews today, and that's perfectly fine. And I think the problem that's happened on these college campuses today, James Bennett had a great, great, great essay in The Economist's monthly magazine about his, you know, his expulsion, his firing, he wasn't fired, but he was driven out of the New York Times where he was the opinion editor. And he said, the Times' problem has metastasized from liberal bias to illiberal bias, from an inclination to favor one side of the national debate to an impulse to shut down debate altogether. And that's what we've seen on these college campuses for years. When you and I were going to college in the 1980s, there was a liberal bias. It was political correctness was the issue. Now it's not political correctness. It's illiberal bias. It's shutting down of speech. And then all of a sudden, the left has done this 180 because of October 7th. And now all of a sudden, you know, we got to fight illiberalism. We have to fight for the right to free speech. Everyone can say what they need to say. There's nothing that's out of bounds. But they don't believe that. They're just protecting the anti-Semitism.
This is absolutely the problem. And I always want people to understand, you know, Mark and I have been talking a lot about anti-Semitism since October the 7th, and with good reason. And we really appreciate both the support and the interest we've gotten. But just remember, you know, what the Jewish people always say, it always starts with us, but it never ends with us. And I think that's critical to remember, because it's not just going to be about Jews. It's not just going to be about Israel. It will go on to be about every other thing. This illiberalism is a poison. It's a poison in our country. It really is. And it is destroying our institutions of higher learning, and it is turning our kids into avatars of illiberalism who need to be deprogrammed once they leave school. This is really, there is no higher priority than the young people and their of a country, right? They are, Danny said, coining a beautiful phrase, our future. And we want our future to be liberal in the classical sense, not in the sense that is being beaten into them in these places. We got to get to our interview. I'm sure everybody has heard of Lawrence Summers, Larry Summers, we call him. He's an internationally known economist. He's had so many jobs in so many administrations, I'm not going to list them all. But he was the Secretary of the Treasury during the Obama administration. He was the president of Harvard University. He had taught for many years at Harvard University, and he became their 27th president from 2001 to 2006. He is just an unbelievably thoughtful person, and it is a great pleasure to have him here with us.
Here's our interview. Larry Summers, welcome to the podcast.
Very glad to be with you.
We're very glad to have you here. So Harvard has had its, what some might on the right might call its Bud Light moment recently since the October 7th attacks. It's probably suffered more damage to its reputation in a few months than any university I can remember.
what is going on at Harvard right now? And also what's going on more broadly at our universities? There seems to be this explosion of anti-Semitism. So to some extent, the faculties, some extent in the student body, Jewish students don't feel safe on these campuses. What's going on?
It's been a very difficult period for Harvard. If you look at applications, they're down by 17%, which is kind of unprecedented relative to the normal fluctuations. If you look at fundraising, it appears to be very substantially down. Yes, big gifts, but just the fraction of alumni who want to give $100 or $500 has gone way down because people are disillusioned. In fact, people were raising questions about whether they wanted to continue managing Harvard's money, endowment managers, because of concerns about the signal the university had sent. So I think there is a very serious reputational problem that's emerged for Harvard, and that comes out of a particular incident where 35 student groups basically blamed Israel for the Hamas attacks, and inexplicably the university leadership didn't quickly condemn that act and disassociate Harvard from those 35 student groups. But I think this is the tip of an iceberg of problem that goes way beyond Harvard and in many ways goes beyond the anti-Semitism issue. It seems to me that universities have to have a consistent standard on prejudice, a consistent standard on free speech. And what's become completely clear is that types of expression and conduct that are forcefully condemned, that lead to people's ostracism, where you're talking about racism, or you're talking about misogyny, or you're talking about homophobia, are seen as acceptable debate and discourse when you're talking about anti-Semitism. And that double standard, it seems to me, is completely unacceptable. It's felt by many Jewish students to be completely unacceptable, and they're right. And it's a very difficult set of issues as to how one goes forward to address that double standard. Probably there needs to be much more resistance to anti-Semitic speech, but probably also there needs not to be the kind of hypersensitivity that there has been around discussions of race, around discussions of gender differences, around discussions of law enforcement. And there needs to be openness to a much wider range of views. With respect to anti-Semitism, I have been surprised but not shocked and very disillusioned by the upsurge of what I would call left-wing anti-Semitism, which I think is a different phenomenon than much traditional anti-Semitism, but hardly a new phenomenon. Look at Jeremy Corbyn. Look at history of Stalin's Russia. There has always been a stream of virulent anti-Judaism in left-wing ideas. And as Israel has come to seem an example of an imperialist and colonialist state to some, there has been a tendency to demonize Israel in ways that I think are very, very problematic. I very much understand that there's a distinction between opposing Israeli policy and being anti-Semitic, that there's even a distinction between being anti-Zionist and being anti-Semitic. But when so many people are so elaborately concerned with what they see as Israeli injustice towards Palestinians and are so ostentatiously unconcerned with Palestinian suffering at the hands of other Arab states, when they are so unconcerned about suffering of other minority groups in Africa, in Asia, in other continents, and so much of the focus is on only the Jewish state, that I think one does have to see, as I said many years ago, that a lot of what thoughtful and reasonable people are advocating is anti-Semitic in what its effect would be, if not perhaps in their intent. I think the leaders of great universities have fallen way short of being willing to make that point in a clear way. And I think the reason is a lack of courage and a lack of willingness to accept controversy with progressive elements, or so-called progressive elements within their faculty.
So you used the word anti-colonial there. One of the things long before October 7th that sort of infected the academy is this rise of critical theory and this division of the world into oppressor and oppressed. And this is what feeds a lot of the woke agenda on these campuses, that, you know, if you're an oppressor, nothing you say or nothing you do is justifiable. If you're oppressed, anything you say and anything you do is justified. And this is what justifies Hamas's atrocities on October 7th. How connected is this rise of anti-Semitism on campuses with the rise of critical theory?
I'm not an expert on critical theory enough to give you a highly confident opinion on that. And I think it's worth remembering that college campuses were places where people chanted "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh." And were places where people admired Che Guevara long before critical theory was invented. So I think there is an attraction of a certain kind of very left academic mentality to certain kinds of ideas that seem to me to be quite crazy. That actually antedates the invention of critical theory.
That's right.
So I think blaming it all on critical theory is actually a mistake, though that does not make it any better or any more justifiable.
It's an accelerant. It's fundamentally what it is. I couldn't agree with you more. So you used a word to describe this phenomenon and the reaction. So, you know, the campus phenomenon and then the reaction of the powers that be on campus. And you used the word inexplicable. And I want to come back to that because this isn't hard. Kids on campus have had radical and even crazy genocide-supporting views, as you rightly say, in the 60s, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, Che Guevara, it's a luxury. Winston Churchill talked about this. It's a luxury to be dumb when you're young, to embrace radical causes. But these are the grown-ups. And to me, I've written about my daughter who's at Vanderbilt and how Chancellor Diermeier there has handled this. We're a university. We're not in politics. We're not signing up to BDS. We're not letting you wear masks, and we're not letting you call for the genocide of anybody. So forget it. Right? That's it. You don't have to come out one way or another. Why was this so hard for those who got caught up in the way they did on Capitol Hill?
I don't think it should have been so hard. I think that more effective communication would not have been difficult. And it's certainly not my intention to make excuses for what I think was one of the least successful instances of institutional representation in history. When you turn your university into a Saturday Night Live skit, that is a consequential leadership failure. That having been said, I would say some other things. Testimony before a congressional committee is a kind of performance art.
True.
When the Congress people are performing and in full performance mode, and the people who testified unsuccessfully hadn't had experience with that kind of performance art. And that's important to recognize in judging. The issues are difficult. It is the Supreme Court of the United States that concluded that it was okay, indeed obligatory, to allow the Nazis to march in support of Nazism through Skokie, Illinois, a town distinguished by the number of Holocaust survivors who lived within it, at a time when the residents weren't the descendants of Holocaust survivors. They were Holocaust survivors, and that's what our Supreme Court mandated. And so free speech does have its pull. The challenge is not so much to be in a competition as to who can strongly censor speech. It's to recognize, and this has been what I've always said about this, that academic freedom does not include freedom from criticism. And that an ability to call out in sharp, vivid, and clear terms that which is morally wrong, so people don't want to engage in it, so others learn not to follow those who are speaking in outrageous ways, that is an important part of the task of leadership. And so if we're debating what should be punished and what shouldn't be punished and the nuances of the First Amendment, we've already lost. What we need to do is just set some clear moral tone on right and wrong. And if we did that, I think we would be in a much better place on our college campuses. This has been building for a long time. The Harvard Student newspaper, several years ago, endorsed the idea of boycott, divest, sanction,
right,
Israel.
Right.
And then administration of the university said that it had various doctrines of not believing in boycotting and divesting in general, but it did not treat the singling out of Israel as any kind of moral problem and wasn't willing to. Well, that's the kind of tolerance that allows this to grow. And I think that I was very much influenced many, many years ago by an old conservative idea, the broken windows theory of criminology and how that creates the conditions for social decay and rising criminality. I think with respect to the excesses in the name of progressive causes, we've had a kind of broken windows theory operative where nothing is called out and therefore the excesses increase and the culture changes. And we've now gotten to a moment where how far off we've gotten has been made very salient in a very public way with far-reaching consequences for these institutions. And the irony is that for many of those, and I'm to the left of most people at the AEI, it is going to backfire terribly. The reason Ronald Reagan got successfully elected governor of California over Pat Brown, who had done extraordinary things in terms of making higher education available universally to anyone who graduated from high school in the state of California, a staggering achievement by the standards of the 1960s. But he lost badly to Ronald Reagan, and the reason he lost badly was that Ronald Reagan ran against the excesses of what was happening at Berkeley. And that was a central theme of Ronald Reagan's campaign. So I think it's very important what symbolism we create.
I couldn't agree more. I guess, and maybe you've already answered me. First of all, I love your broken windows analogy, and it is hilarious to me because, A, I've done a lot of work on cops and policing. Until recently, it was one of our most best-selling books was on that topic, that in fact, this has been adopted by the left as a tool of censorship and excess in a way. I would be much less disturbed by the Saturday Night Live episode of the three college presidents on Capitol Hill, which I think you're right, is performance art and actually is hard, even if you're kind of a good guy, and I don't think they are. But the professors, and what we see is not simply that this is a small proportion of the professoriate, this is a big proportion of the professoriate. And if you take that problem, not simply as a, okay, it's an October 7th problem, but as a problem that these are the people who are teaching our kids at the most elite level, where do you go?
There's a difference between being brilliant and being smart or wise. And professors are chosen for being brilliant in their niches of inquiry. And that does not necessarily make them smart or wise about the formation of the character of young people or about the effective operation of institutions. And there has been an excessive abdication by trustees and by university leaders to faculty tastes and to the kinds of values and tastes that lead people to decide to be faculty members. And I don't think the answer lies in political litmus tests on who can teach Shakespeare or who can teach quantum theory or even who can teach econometrics. I think the answer lies in the faculty focusing on where they have expertise and the broader governance coming in other kinds of places. And if university leaders were less subservient to their faculty, I think it would be very helpful. Let me take an example. One of the challenges that, and I sympathize with university leaders, is it is easy for us to sit here and say on some podcast that if students break into a classroom and use a megaphone and disrupt it for a minute, their names will be taken and they will then be subject to discipline. Unfortunately, discipline is by design, though not appropriate design, the prerogative of the faculty. And the faculty is highly prone to engage in a kind of academic equivalent of juror nullification
right.
on discipline issues with respect to progressive people pursuing progressive causes. I was embarrassed for Harvard. There was, at least according to the press reports, there were a group of students who occupied one of our central administration buildings all night, despite having been asked to leave repeatedly. I understand why nobody sent the police in with the possibility of a violent and explosive episode. I understand that decision, and I might well have made the same decision if it had been my decision to make. What I cannot understand is how anyone with the title of dean, was permitted to pass burritos in through the window so that the students in that administration building could feel well fed during their all-night occupation without being condemned criticized or fired by their superiors. That was something I could not understand.
So you mentioned earlier the neo-Nazis marching in Skokie and how that was at that. Of course, they weren't from that community. They were allowed to come in and they had the First Amendment right to march. But there are, as far as I know, no neo-Nazis on the faculty of Harvard. But there are people who preach the same philosophy towards Jews on the faculty of Harvard. I mean, if I were to a Harvard faculty member and I published a paper saying that black people in this country from sea to shining sea should be driven out of this country by violence if necessary and sent back to Africa or wherever they came from, and I was on the faculty of Harvard, I would be fired, wouldn't I? I would be shamed out of the university. So
you would be, I think we need to be clear. You would...
I would never be hired to begin with.
Well, there's that.
That's a different thing.
Yeah.
You would certainly be very strongly condemned in clear and vivid ways which go beyond the ways that anti-Semites have been condemned.
Yeah.
And that's why there is a strong double standard. I think there is somewhat less actual firing and actual application of discipline for outrageous statement in a right-wing direction than is often supposed. What happens is that it is condemned and deterred in broader cultural ways, mm-hmm. and that is the real failure. And so I think we need to be very careful, and I think some of my friends on the conservative side do need to remember that their forebears were actively taking the position as alumni and trustees of universities in the 1950s that the Samuelson textbook should be banned because it taught Keynesian economics, and Keynesian economics was a tool of communism. And that was a position that was being taken by conservatives who some regard as heroic today. William F. Buckley came very close to positions of that kind. So I think the better positions are not to get excited about how more people need to get fired about more things, but instead need to be about three other ideas. That nobody can speak for the university. You can only speak for yourself. That order has to be maintained, and you can't disrupt the rights of others to speak. And that all perspectives need to be represented, and that there's an obligation to hear people with many different points of view.
I get. Let me take firing off the table for a second and just put it in the broader context. Harvard has on the fire rating the lowest free speech rating in the entire of all 248 universities.
We had the head of fire on the podcast as well.
Universities in the country. So it's not a free speech friendly university to begin with. All of a sudden, since this came up, everybody's a First Amendment champion, right? You know, oh my gosh, well, we have to suspend free speech. It's like when conservatives want to come and present mainstream views on these campuses, first of all, if you're a faculty member, you have to sign a DEI statement to even get to be a faculty member and bow to the orthodoxy. And if you want to come speak, or if your professor wants to come speak, then you're policed. But then all of a sudden you can call from the river to the sea, Palestine must be free, all the Jews should be pushed into the sea and, genocide. That's okay, and that's defended, and suddenly they become free speech champions. I mean, how do we balance our love for free speech?
I've been plenty critical of Harvard here in this in this discussion,
and very publicly.
So, but I think it's also important not to exaggerate in order to be credible. I've looked very hard at that ranking of Harvard as last. I am not proud of where Harvard is on free speech, but because things at Harvard get publicized and because it's dramatic to make Harvard last, that is not a fair representation of what happens to it. What happens at Harvard relative to other universities. DEI statements I cannot defend as reasonable or appropriate. I do think, and that's how I began this discussion, that there is a double standard around different forms of prejudice. But I would urge us to be a little bit careful in where we're proposing to start condemning and firing people and not allowing people to march and to say things. I think one needs to be very freedom respecting. At the same time, one has to be very culture forming. And the large problems have been that there has been no effort to establish a climate in which anti-Semitism is unacceptable. And that has been the real failure of leadership, not a failure of punishing people for speaking or punishing people for participating in demonstrations. And that is the balance that has to be struck with very considerable care.
I think that's fair. And, you know, obviously, that was perhaps the true disservice that Claudine Gay ended up performing for Harvard, is that she ended up putting Harvard in the crosshairs for something. And of course, everybody else was delighted to go along because of what Harvard represents. So let me ask you, one of the very interesting things for us as we have been talking about politics, it, not just the problem of the anti-Semitism, the problem of the double standard and the insane broken windows of the left, which I'm going to use again and again, is this the phenomenon of elites. So Rui Teixeira, who is now a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, I'd say a very unusual transfer from the Center for American Progress, which and the guys died in the wool, you know, good 1970s. John Judas is my co-author, hippie. But he talks about the elite capture of the left, which I think is it very wrapped up in how the Donald Trump phenomenon has happened. And of course, Harvard, you know, placed itself squarely right there where everybody was ready to say, aha. So how, you know, you were there. This is one of the finest institutions in the country. I don't want to ask you specifically about Harvard, but I do want to ask you what your theory is, especially as a, am I wrong in saying you're a lifelong Democrat? You're a lifelong Democrat. How it is that the Democratic Party has ended up becoming the party of coastal elites, Harvard, not just Harvard, Yale and Princeton presidents, and not the party that it once was.
I think being active, being involved counts. And a lot of very able people with the kind of luxury beliefs, philosophy that you describe, have energized themselves very substantially and very fully. And as the institutions have opened themselves up and been less closed and been not any longer able to be dominated by party bosses, that desirable reform has made them more susceptible to being captured by energized elites with luxury beliefs, particularly when they're able to form coalitions with members of traditionally disadvantaged groups. And I think it is the great dilemma of the current Democratic Party that, and this is the example I always use, there's a famous picture we've all seen of three guys sitting on a girder over New York City, eating, belted to the girder, eating their lunch.
Wonderful picture.
And that picture was the essence of the Roosevelt Democrat voters. And today's reality is that two out of three of those people are no longer Democrats. And
if that is, if you're lucky,
the central challenge, it seems to me, for a traditional conception of the Democratic Party. And the old Democratic Party, let's face it, the Roosevelt Democratic Party was racism tolerant. A highly important part of its coalition was the South. The Social Security reform legislation, historic though it was crafted in ways that had important racist elements.
So I completely understand. And by the way, that is a really evocative visual, that transformation, and all of us know that picture as well. I think the question becomes, how does this change? You know, Charles Murray wrote this book called Coming Apart about not the fact that there are class differences, but the fact that Harvard used to be a place where country club boys came, and then they married the secretary, and there were lots of class mixing, lots of zip code mixing, and those things haven't happened anymore. And this seems like a phenomenon that's just going to drive our country further and further apart, even further than we are now. How do we fix it? I know,
I'm an economist, not a sociologist, so I don't know the answer completely. But I would hope that we would see some rejuvenation of the notion of patriotism, which is a concept that has largely faded away in discussions in many parts of our country. One of the things that disturbed me most during my time as president of Harvard was the realization that I was the first Ivy League president in 30 years to attend an ROTC commissioning ceremony, which reflected the degree of estrangement between universities and the people who risk their lives to protect us. And I think our leading institutions need to recognize that as leading institutions, they are citizens of our country, institutional citizens of our country, and that citizenship comes with responsibilities as well as with privileges. And I think with the challenges that we face right now, the responsibilities to contribute to our national security at a time when our country's under more threat than it has been in a long time is a very real one. And if there is any silver lining in any of this, it might be that the existence of a common threat will cause Americans to be bound more tightly together because of that common threat than they had been previously.
You know, you're right that patriotism is the answer, but patriotism is declining. There was a Wall Street Journal poll that came out recently that I'll get the numbers wrong, but they're roughly this. Like 30 years ago, 70% of Americans said that patriotism was very important to them. It's down to something like 36%. And among younger Americans, it's like in like 18%. And also the NAEP scores, you know, we focus a lot on the math and reading and the NAEP scores. The scores on civics and history are declining too. So we're not teaching our kids the basics of history. We're not instilling them in the patriotism before they get to the universities. And then they get to the universities and they're being taught that America is a systemically racist country that was founded to perpetuate slavery. Like, if patriotism is the answer, what's the academy's responsibility to fix that?
It is a failure. It is a failure of the academy. I can't defend what has come of very large parts of the history profession. I can defend very little of what goes on in the nation's education schools, where indoctrination about injustice seems a much larger theme than efficacious ways to teach people to read. And one has to hope that leaders will emerge. I think there is a tendency for intellectuals to want to say something, things that are new, rather than echo things that are old. And as some of these very problematic ideas have increasingly become conventional wisdom, I wonder if that won't set the stage for them to be challenged, because that's always what happens. That there is a kind of dialect, that there is a kind of dialectic, and things will move back in the right direction. I think our university leaders used to see the whole education system as their key supplier of students and take a strong interest in what was being taught in schools and how that contributed to our broad national project. And that emphasis, I think, has been lost on the part of many university leaders of late, with unfortunate consequences.
Let's, as an exit question, let's conclude sort of where we began with the rise of anti-Semitism. You've described anti-Semitism as become, at the start of this podcast, as it's sort of become an elite phenomenon on the left. And I've heard you talk about how the prioring process of becoming a tenured professor, you almost have to, you have to make a DEI statement and write an essay as part of your application. Talk about that. And how do we talk about the problem of how conservatives are getting filtered out by the DEI bureaucracy from faculties? And how do we overcome that and restore some diversity of thought, not just in the speakers that come to campus, because that's fine if, you know, somebody comes for a day and gives a lecture. We could have more of that tomorrow if we wanted to. How do we fix the faculties and restore, if you really believe in diverse, the D in diversity, DEI, it should be intellectual diversity too, shouldn't it?
These are very hard problems. Let's start with the easy things. If we pursue excellence and we are open to excellence, no matter what its background, that's probably the most important thing we can do for both diversity and for excellence. And widening the circle of opportunity for everyone, eliminating any kind of discrimination based on the color of your skin, your beliefs, the income of your parents, the place where you grew up, any of it, that's the most powerful and important thing we can do to pursue opportunity, to pursue excellence, to pursue diversity, and that is where all the emphasis should be. Second, we should get rid of litmus test statements. Litmus test statements for people who want to be professors, where they're asked to express their fealty or demonstrate their past loyalty to pursuing increased representation of members of certain groups. I don't think that has any place in a liberal institution. No place, because you shouldn't have loyalty oaths. And that which you're asking loyalty to is probably not in its totality likely to be very constructive. I think the problem of having a more ideologically balanced faculty is a complicated one. I think people need to recognize this. If you believe in capitalism, you have many choices in life. You can work for a company. You can work for a university. There are many places you can work. If you hate capitalism, there are many fewer places that you can work. And therefore, even if universities don't have any biases at all, there's a tendency for the people who end up in universities to be substantially more anti-capitalism than the general population. Brilliant. And once they're there, people in all walks of life have a tendency to choose people like them. But to assume that this is all due to discrimination and bad motives is, I think, a mistake, rather than to recognize the natural selection mechanism. And I guess I would say to my conservative friends that I share your aversion to homophily of belief within universities and all of that. But I think you need to be very careful
about saying things that will sound like you're advocating the kind of affirmative action programs for conservatives who don't quite make the cut that you condemn when they're advocated for groups that are chosen or identified in other ways. And so I think if we can all circle back to the idea of as wide a circle as possible so as to maximize opportunity, because that's what creates the most excellence, and we can keep it at that simple proposition, I think that offers the best prospect going forward.
That's wonderful. I would add one PS to that, which is that none of us would care if our anthropology teacher was a communist, or if our math teacher was a socialist, or if our gym teacher was a fascist, if they didn't talk about politics. That's a big part of this, is that everything has now become political, and the American Medical Association has a position on Gaza.
I think that you're right. And I, you know, there's been a lot of discussion of the so-called Calvin principles in universities. Mm-hmm. The idea that universities should be institutionally neutral, that they shouldn't take political positions. And I think that's right. But I think you have to be very careful, because universities also need to set a moral tone. They need to make clear that chanting about genocide is very much not what we stand for and something that appalls us. And you don't want to make it impossible to set that moral tone. And the university also has to protect itself from having its prestige hijacked by subgroups within it. And when groups form and start the Princeton coalition against this and the Harvard coalition against that, the universities have an obligation to disassociate their name from movements of that kind. So these are things that have to be managed very carefully.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you so much. Thank you for taking the time. Thank you for really deep insight. I'm so grateful. I enjoyed it immensely.
I did too. Thank you.
Okay, Danny, so that was so great. And I told Larry afterwards that it reminded me of the scene with Adam Sandler in the movie Billy Madison, where he delivers this absolutely moronic answer in a debate about where he is asked about the Industrial Revolution. The president of the principal of the school says, "Everyone is now dumber because of having listened to it. I award you no points and may God have mercy on your soul." This was like the exact opposite. I came out of that conversation feeling like I am a lot smarter because I listened to Larry Summers for the past 40 minutes talking. And he has this amazing way of using, you know, analogies and word pictures to bring home an issue. Two of them struck me, but one particular, his point about, you know, that if you believe in capitalism, you've got a lot of options. And so you can go into private sector, you can go the other way that. But if you don't believe in capitalism, you're basically stuck with academia. Because that's your only thing that you can do that's not capitalistic. And that's why we have this liberal bias in the academy. And, you know, in a way, James Bennett is wrong in his essay on the Times, because he says liberal bias has metastasized into illiberal bias. It's been layered on. We still have the liberal bias. It's got a second layer of illiberal bias on top of it, which is not just that there's not enough conservative thought on the campus and an overwhelming left-wing thought, but also the left-wing thought is trying to stamp out and shut down, the purveyors of left-wing thought are trying to stamp and shut down anybody who tries to question their ideology. So it's like you've got, you know, liberalism with a dose of Stalinism on top of it. And that's a huge, huge problem.
But part of the problem is because, you know, and we've talked about this many times before, part of the problem is because the left in America is no longer what the left in America was. I loved that analogy about the picture, right? The picture is called Lunch Atop a Skyscraper. If you guys want to see it, I'm sure you've seen it, but Google just that. There's actually a whole Wikipedia entry. It was a photo taken in 1932 of 11 iron workers sitting on a steel beam building the RCA building in Manhattan. What he, I think, correctly says is, all of those workers would have been Democrats in 1932. Now, probably 2/3 of them, and I'm willing to bet actually more, are Republicans. And this is what's happened to the Democratic Party. It is made up of these elitist, woke tyrants who we see sort of in caricature at the top of America's best universities. But it's not just the top of America's best universities. If you go and look at the White House, what you will see is that everybody there, except Joe Biden, hilariously, right, who famously graduated in the bottom 10% of his class, everybody there is the product of an elite university. Everybody there espouses the ideas of Claudine Gay. Everybody at these places is, in fact, in this woke cesspool that they cannot climb out of because they don't know anybody who sits on a beam, brings his lunch, and builds a building anymore. They have contempt for those people. And that jibes perfectly, Mark, with what you said about the great communist capitalist problem, which is that if you don't know anybody who's a capitalist or a worker, then you're not going to do things that are good for his interests.
Well, I mean, in a way, what's happening to the universities is what happened to communism and the Soviet communism, which is that the Democratic Party used to be a coalition of the elites and the working class, right? And now the working class is leaving the left and it's joining the Republican Party. And so what you have now is a party that's become the party of the elites. And in the Soviet Union, what happened? Well, if you look at Poland, how did communism fall apart? The proletariat rose up against the dictatorship of the proletariat, right? Why was Solidarity such a force against to bringing down communism? Is because it proved that they no longer represented the working class. And that's sort of what's happening to the academy right now. All these left-wing elites were championing working people against the corporate forces in the world. And now the working people are basically rejecting them. And so what do they represent? They just represent their own niche, anti-colonial, CRT, oppressor versus oppressed ideology. And they're all alone. And so they become more angry and more desperate and more Stalinist with every day that they're rejected by their own, the people they claim to be trying to be the vanguard of.
That was an epic rant, if I may say so.
Thank you. And we've had some epic rants on here. So, exactly. That's quite a compliment, Danny. Thank you.
There you go. All right.
Larry Summers inspires me. And I'm afraid we wouldn't agree with all of that, but still.
In any case, it was epic and a very fine point on which to end this really terrific podcast. I really enjoyed having Larry on, I confess. Thank you all for being with us. Let us know what you think. Let us know on the Substack. Let us know by email. We love to hear from you.
Let us know what topics you'd like us to cover. You can get in touch with the show by emailing us at whatthehell@aei.org.
Or you can reach us on Twitter. I'm at D. Pletka.
And I'm at Mark Thiessen. That's Mark with a C.
Please rate and review the podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, share it, comment on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this.
Thanks for listening.